Hello there, you Awakening Wonders on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you download your podcasts. We really appreciate you, our listeners, and want to bring you more content. We will be delivering a podcast every day, 7 days a week. Every single day, you'll get a detailed breakdown of current topics that the mainstream media should be covering. But if they are covering, they're amplifying establishment messages and not telling you the truth. Once a week, we bring you in-depth conversations with guests like Jordan Peterson, RFK Jr., Sam Harris, Vandana Shiva, Gabor Mate, and many more. Now enjoy this episode of Stay Free with Russell Brand. Remember, there's an episode every single day to educate and elevate our consciousness together. Stay free and enjoy the episode.
No, here's the fucking news.
Hello there, you Awakening Wonders. Thanks for joining me today for Stay Free with Russell Brand. Won't someone please think of the children? Hello, everyone in the Rumble chat. How are you getting on? I hope you're being nice to one another in there, because if we can find ways of forming new alliances, we are unstoppable. This great awakening must continue because people are rejecting globalism and establishment edicts all over the world. The Irish, I think you say Taoiseach. Taoiseach has, well, he's shockingly resigned because of the failure of that bill where they wanted to change the word to family to gang and the word to for woman or something. I mean, they're mucking about over there. Especially, well, one of the things he doesn't mention in his resignation speech is that they're trying to force through peculiar, vague hate speech laws to legitimise further control over open communication in the great nation of Ireland. We'll talk about that. In fact, we've got a whole piece on that. You're going to love that because it exposes, once again, the way that elites hate ordinary people. Not are they only detached from ordinary people, they loathe them, they want to crush ordinary people. Traditions, values, everything that we hold dear and believe in is being crushed to a powder beneath their feet so that they can impose more elitist control. We've also got, we asked you earlier what story you wanted us to cover in detail. It was the CDC redacting a COVID study, so we're covering that in some detail a little later in the show, obviously off YouTube, because YouTube, as you know, a great platform. And if you're watching us there, I love you, you awakening wonder, how I love you. But the WHO are still able to censor that platform. Well, the WHO don't censor that platform. YouTube internally used the WHO guidelines to censor on that platform. And censorship is something we'll be talking about in some detail as well, because the New York Times has asked us to take a new look at those unsung heroes, deep state agents. I mean, what is this? It's not James Bond. It's not even glorifying them. It's actually sort of saying it's normalizing them. We'll be talking about escalations in Ukraine also. So if you're watching us on YouTube, we'll be there for about 15 minutes. Then we're going to be exclusively in that sweet, sweet stream of glorious freedom. So, oh, that's freedom water right there. Not we, freedom water we are drinking. Okay, let's get into it, guys. Let's go. So, first of all, the New York Times are, they're telling us that we should have another look at the deep state. There you go. It turns out the deep state is actually kind of awesome. You'll notice that Elon Musk has responded to that. The police are replacing suspects' faces with Lego heads. Doesn't seem right, does it? And the man that set up that Willy Wonka theme park place in Scotland that fascinated us all for so long has actually been, it sounds like, sort of suffering. It's not actually very nice. He's lost friends. He's lost the love of his life. He's lost the world of imagination that he was determined to live in. He fell in a chocolate river. He's been sucked up a tube. He can't get anywhere near an Oompa Loompa anymore. And he's become commonly known, colloquially at least, as Willy Wonka. It's a difficult time for him. There's no question about that. We asked you what story you wanted to see. You told us that you're mostly interested in the CDC story. And we've already told you that there's been a massive fail and rejection for the globalist elites, because in Ireland, people seem to care about tradition and God and family rather than the globalist agenda that seems hell-bent on uprooting us from our communities, from one another, using, as always, the protection of some... I believe that people should be who you are. Whoever you are, that should be treasured and honoured, and love is love. But I don't think that the globalist establishment cares about that. Let's have a look at the Irish Taoiseach's resignation. That's Prime Minister in our language, President in your language. And notice that when he's talking about his legacy of modernity, which is an odd oxymoron, I suppose. Let's note that he doesn't talk about the hate speech laws that are being imposed on the Irish people right now, along with other legislation that they're pretty against. There's a massive migration crisis in that country. That, let me know if you're watching this from Ireland right now. People are absolutely fuming. I laughed way too hard at Willy Wanker, said the nerd far away in our Rumble chat. Hey, if we can't have a good laugh at Willy Wanker together, what kind of people are we? If we can't pop on a beautiful pink bonnet, it's the black t-shirt that's our merch item of the week this week, then you know, what kind of country or planet are we living in? Let's have a look at Varadkar's resignation.
I've had the privilege to serve for the past 20 years as a public representative, 13 as a member of cabinet, 7 as leader of my party, and most of those as Taoiseach of this great country. It has been the most fulfilling time of my life.
Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it, because the Irish people are fucking furious.
Working with colleagues, I've had the honour of helping to lead Ireland from unemployment to full employment, from a budget deficit to budget surplus, from austerity to prosperity, through a pandemic in which we saved lives and livelihoods, through Brexit.
Oh, I mean, it's really amazing, isn't it? That Brexit, by the way, that shouldn't, what's that got to do with the people of Ireland? Also, what I would say is the pandemic wasn't a like triumph all around for globalism, was it? It was a time where we learned that massive censorship was being pushed on us. We'll be covering that in more detail, that we were not being told the truth about many aspects of the pandemic, social and political policies, medical policies. Yeah.
When we prevented a hard border between North and South and protected our place in Europe. I'm proud that we've made the country a more equal and more modern place when it comes to the rights of children, the LGBT community, equality for women and their bodily autonomy.
It's a more modern and equal place where we can throw you all in jail for using language that we don't agree with. Modernity is being equated with centralised bureaucracies and affinity with the EU that I would argue don't care about you. Lindsey Graham is advocating, as usual, for war, spending Ukrainian lives like oil. It's astonishing to watch this. Look also at how romantically rendered this whole thing is. Lindsey Graham, first of all, is visiting Zelensky in some sort of ludicrously ornate golden palace before describing how Ukrainian people should hurl themselves in front of cannon fire in order to facilitate, one might argue, the agenda of BlackRock and Raytheon. Let's have a look at it.
Thank you very much, Senator, and your team. Thanks for coming. That's a good signal for us, for Ukrainians. And of course, from the very beginning, let me to be thankful to the United States, to people of your country, your bipartisan support, and to President, his administration. Thanks so much.
Before we say anything, I just admire what you and your people have been able to do for 2 years. I remember we were told he would fall in 4 weeks. We're still here.
It's weird, isn't it, the way this is being romanticized and the way we're being retold this story as if it is somehow a success rather than the annihilation of many Ukrainian lives, the expenditure of many, many US tax dollars, the provocation of a nuclear superpower. I'm wondering why the deal that Zelensky had with Putin a couple of years ago would not have been a better alternative. Can you tell me in the chat, why would a diplomatic solution 2 years ago not have been better? How many hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian people have died? And let's face it, all of us now face the prospect of a nuclear war if we continue to provoke Russia.
Still fighting. Putin won in a landslide.
Oh, no democracy over there in Russia. Not like America, where we have a great democracy where you can vote for Joe Biden. And if you vote for anyone else, you're voting for tyranny. And in Ukraine, where there are no elections at all.
You know why he got 87%? Because I guess he didn't want 88. That would look bad. So this is the 10th anniversary of the annexation of Crimea.
What?
So, better days ahead for the people of Ukraine. And Putin will go down in history the way all the people like Putin go down in history. Just a matter of time.
I don't know. I don't I don't even understand the propaganda anymore. It's really, really confusing. Over here in Europe, there's a prominent intellectual called Slavoj Žižek, who has been much admired for his ability to analyse and scrutinise pop cultural artefacts and present new perspectives on, I don't know, important issues, cultural issues. But his appearance on a British streaming show is pretty sort of confusing. Have a look at this for yourself, because he is a much treasured intellectual and philosopher of the left. Here, he says that Russia, I'll tell you what he says. He says that they're worse than Arabs, which I think that's racist in a couple of ways. And also that we should give Ukraine nuclear weapons. And that seems dangerous in a few ways. But I don't know, man. He's a clever guy. Maybe I'm missing something. Let's check it out.
He's a dark, conservative, religious fanatic. That's why to provoke people, as you know, I think I said give even nuclear arms to Ukraine.
On that point, Slavoj,
yeah,
I think it was a terrible mistake for Ukraine to be persuaded to give up their nuclear capability, because it seemed to me that was just a green light to Putin.
I don't think we're addressing these issues correctly. I don't think we're addressing it correctly. It can't be. The answer can't be, let's have more people with nuclear weapons. That's the solution to this. When are we going to address the possibility that we're living in a bizarre simulacrum? When are we going to address the possibility that there is a globalist conspiracy to drive us into centralization, authoritarianism, and to control us at the biometric level? When are we going to reorganize, reorder, and oppose this peculiar agenda? Surely there's a better solution than giving nuclear weapons to everybody, particularly people that are likely to get involved in hot wars with similarly nuclear-armed opponents, in this case, Russia. But it's not just that terrifying potential threat of Armageddon that we have to countenance. Of course, the apocalypse encroaches in the Middle East too. Here's this is a good post by Aaron Mate, who's someone who faces a lot of ire and attacks and spying from the legacy media for his opposition to the war. Have a look. Last week, Secretary Blinken boasted that the Israelis have been not only allowing food in, but also working to make sure it gets in and gets to people who need it. He then took credit for doing everything possible to maximise aid to Gaza. Today, he admits that 100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food security. Let's have a look at both of those clips and see if we can make sense of this living paradox.
Of course, the Israelis have been not only allowing food in, they have been working to make sure that it gets in and gets to people who need it. We've seen throughout this process, first the opening of Rafah back in October, after my first visit to Israel, many hours of discussion, Rafah opened, assistance began to get in. We went back some weeks later. We got agreement to open Kerem Shalom.
I'm actually confused by the moral framing of this situation now that there is obviously at least a humanitarian crisis, if not a massacre. And I know people would use even more incendiary language to describe what's happening in Gaza. 34,000 people have died in the weeks since October the 7th, which in itself, of course, was a horrific and tragic event. So there's obviously, as you know, I'm sure you know, the Biden administration are supplying arms to Israel, being careful to ensure that it doesn't breach the congressional requirement for sign-off by keeping the orders below a certain threshold. That's already concerning, I would say. And now there's the sort of attempt to kind of bomb and kill while present it as a sort of opportunity for philanthropy that we should all be patting ourselves on the back. I mean, Antony Blinken's sort of pleased with himself. Here's what he's said now, though, that indeed the people in Gaza are facing, well, there's no nice word for it, starvation.
According to the most respected measure of these things, 100% of the population in Gaza is at severe levels of acute food insecurity. That's the first time an entire population has been so classified.
Acute food insecurity does sound better than starvation.
We also see, again, according to, in this case, the United Nations, 100%, the totality of the population, is in need of humanitarian assistance.
Okay, there we are. It's a confusing, war-torn world. And those of us that believe a spiritual solution is required, those of us that believe that these systems and institutions are failing deeply and what's required is a radical redress, something that somehow fuses together a return to the arcane, the reverence of nature, the reverence of community and family, the sovereignty of the individual, the open embrace of God are regarded as crackpots. Okay, let's have a look at what's happening in your country with regard to censorship. You know that during the pandemic, the Biden administration, through their deep state armory, were censoring what happened on social media. The Twitter files first revealed that. It's obviously continuing. And when the Supreme Court said it was against your First Amendment rights, i.e. your right for free speech, the Biden administration pushed back. And it seems that they will be successful in being allowed to continue with this ongoing pressuring of social media sites to censor in accordance with their wishes. This is what Elon Musk has said on the subject. This is him sort of talking about the New York Times. It's the New York Times story that we started with, which was pretty surprising. Remember, coming up, we're going to be talking about the CDC's redacted COVID documents, some of which are 100% redacted, because that's what you wanted us to talk about in detail. We'll be on YouTube for another 5 minutes, and then you're going to have to click the link in the description to join us in that sweet stream of freedom. No one gundlach. I'm saying goodbye to you as you pop off, and Claude, acute food insecurity will become a geographical phenomena. It will indeed, unless the farmers stay strong and stay bold, because if we can't control food, we are in serious trouble. Let's get into this New York Times headline and how the deep state are kind of awesome. Elon Musk slammed the New York Times for publishing an opinion headline calling the US administrative state and system of unelected government employees kind of awesome. The Times published a video insisting that the so-called public enemies within the government, such as workers for the Environmental Protection Agency, are the same as ordinary Americans. The piece also warned against, surprise, surprise, former President Donald Trump slashing bureaucratic jobs and replacing them with government officials who will serve him. When we hear deep state, instead of recoiling, we should rally, the piece reads. We should think about the workers otherwise unknown as our public servants, the everyday superheroes who wake up ready to dedicate their career and their lives to serving us. These are the Americans we employ, even though their work is often invisible. Yeah, because it's often illegal. That's what's been... What's amazing about this and the Supreme Court case inquiry more generally is that it's been demonstrated that they were wrong about the pandemic. So, oh, thank God we were able to censor Robert Malone and Jay Bhattacharya with all their crazy talk about their not having been clinical trials and that this is gene therapy rather than a vaccine. Thank God we shut that down. Lives could have been lost. Thank God we were able to impose those very successful lockdowns. This is actually amazing. These are the Americans we employ, even though their work is often invisible because it's secret. It often makes our lives better. Are you one of these people that wants an authoritarian state governing and controlling you? Or would you like to be free to run your own life and run your own community? Stop fighting in the chat, you silly, silly sods. But if Donald Trump is re-elected and enacts Schedule F, that could change. He would have the power to eviscerate the so-called deep state, oh no, and replace our public servants with people who work for him, not us. In the video above, you'll meet a few of our hard-working American public servants. I want to see it. And we hope you'll agree that they're not scary at all. In fact, they're kind of awesome, it continued. In just 7 words, Musk wrote in response to the headline, they are the mouthpiece of the state. Some of those, without those heroes of the CIA, who, can I ask you, will conduct coups in Central America and indeed Ukraine? Who is it that you want to set up bases around Ukraine for the last 10 years, provoking Russia into war? And who will carry out some of our most cherished and precious assassinations? You? Who's going to make sure that the Hunter Biden laptop story is suppressed without our friends in the deep states? Ordinary Americans just like you. That is mental. It's insane. And it's carrying on now because the Supreme Court, it looks like, are about to say that the Biden administration can continue to pressure social media sites into censoring in accordance with their wishes. Our friend Glenn Greenwald posted this. KBJ doubles down. My biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways. That's, of course, in reference to Ketanji Brown Jackson's quote, that the First Amendment is hamstringing the government. And as he says, that is quite literally the entire point of the First Amendment, of the entire Bill of Rights, to protect you from the government, to protect you from them. Jim Jordan is, of course, campaigning to prevent the Biden administration being able to assert this level of pressure. Let's have a look at him on a variety of news channels. I think this is mostly him on Fox. Let's have a look.
I think what it comes down to is Justice Alito suggested at one point, actually there's an ensuing argument that is on the same subject, that as long as the government is really subtle about coercing, it might be able to do that, or the Supreme Court might not be able to interfere with it. So that would leave the FBI to embed itself with social media companies, take down the Hunter Biden laptop in election after election after election, if that's the way that turns out.
What do you make of that, Congressman Jordan?
Well, that's what happened. You did have the FBI doing that. But the big takeaway today was Ketanji Brown Jackson, when she said to the Solicitor General from Louisiana, she said, "You've got the First Amendment hamstringing the government." Well, that's what it's supposed to do, for goodness sake. It was literally one of the craziest things I've ever seen, that you could have a justice on the United States Supreme Court say that in the oral argument. I mean, it made no sense to me. That is frightening, because if she really believes that, That is scary where we're headed. Understand what took place here. This was censorship by surrogate. This was big government telling big tech to take down speech they disagreed with. And it was the most fundamental kind of speech. It was political speech, the kind that's supposed to have the most heightened scrutiny you can have before you can take that down. But that's what took place. And then to have a justice on the Supreme Court say what she said, that is frightening.
Yeah, and some of the things that the government was coercing Facebook and Twitter and others to take down now turned out to be the conventional wisdom, such as what was the origin of COVID.
True. It's true.
As we pointed out, some of the plaintiffs in this case are physicians. One of them, Aaron Curiati.
It's amazing, because they weren't right. This is what I'd like to reiterate, that the censorship that was practiced during that time was incorrect. It's not like they're able to say, well, you know, like, people were concerned that there were no clinical trials or evidence that the vaccine was effective against transmission. That was true. It's not like they're able to say all of this crazy talk about adverse reactions or all this talk of excess deaths. I can't get too far into it because we're still on YouTube. In fact, let's come off YouTube now before we show you the quote from Jim Jordan that really helps you to understand this. A deep hatred of ordinary people from institutional elites. I sometimes wonder if something dark, ulterior, and occultist is at hand, because what can their agenda be? Can it just be the problems of profit and dominion, or is something darker being practiced? Listen, remember, click the link in the description if you're watching us on YouTube right now. We've got all sorts of fantastic exclusive content available for locals, and we're going to do this show for another 40 minutes. See you in a second. Here's Jim Jordan's quote, which I really think actually summarizes things very beautifully. Is that it? No, it's not it. That's the wrong thing. Is that the Jim Jordan quote? The families. Yeah, is that it? Yeah. Is that it? One NSF-funded research team said the quiet part out loud, yeah, when it told NSF that its AI-powered tool could help social media platforms more comprehensively enforce their misinformation policies and thus externalize the difficult responsibility of censorship, exactly as Jim Jordan said. Non-public documents also reveal the condescending way the censors privately talk about Americans, particularly military families, the elderly, rural and indigenous communities, and Americans who hold the Bible and Constitution as sacred. This is hardly surprising to learn that you are regarded in such a manner, that the American people themselves are regarded with not only from a condescending perspective, but also with contempt. That's what concerns me most of all. This, again, is significant because the deep state's involvement and intervention in a social media is still something we're learning more and more about. This is Elon Musk talking about the FBI portal that auto-deleted comms after 2 weeks. We're familiar now with apps, I guess, where we can communicate with one another and have them deleted. But this is odd, because at a time that the Biden administration are lobbying to be able to continue to pressure social media sites to censor in accordance to their whims, we are learning that censorship is difficult to track and understand. And anyone that's ever made a Freedom of Information Act request, and I suggest you all do it to various government departments and their proxies that are set up to crush dissent, will know that it's very difficult to get that information off of them. Why? Because they're spying on you. They're controlling you. They're trying to create a 360 orb of impenetrable information so that we don't wake up here in this simulation and start meaningfully opposing them. Ex-owner Elon Musk revealed during a recent interview that the FBI had a portal that auto-deleted all comms with Twitter after 2 weeks, remarking that it was likely a violation of the Freedom of Information Act. Musk made the comments on the Texas Lindsay podcast while discussing the censorship of Americans on social media. In fact, we've got that, so why don't we, let's have a little listen to that now.
You know, there was, and this is coming from multiple parts of the government, from the State Department, the FBI, Homeland Security, from really many, many parts of the government. It wasn't just one arm of the government. There was this FBI portal that auto-deleted all communications after 2 weeks. So we actually don't know what was said there. In fact, that does strike me as a FOIA violation, a Freedom of Information Act violation, because you shouldn't be able to auto-delete things after 2 weeks. There's a little-known agency in the State Department called the Global Engagement Center, which most people have never heard of, but they might have been the single worst offender because they demanded the suspension of, at one point, over 250,000 accounts, which I think all Twitter largely complied with. Their suspension demands were so broad that they accidentally demanded a suspension of a journalist on CNN and an elected Canadian politician. It was just...
They were censoring so indiscriminately that they were censoring people that they shouldn't censor just because they loved censorship so much. And not only is censorship taking place, the censorship itself is being censored and redacted and controlled. This is the opposite of open government. This is the opposite of government as service and as servants. We are being infantilized by our governments, controlled by our governments, and they are legitimizing their control continually by telling us that they're keeping us safe, even though we can observe almost in real time now that many of the measures they are taking in order to keep us safe are making things worse. The whole creation of the category of malinformation, information that is true but inconvenient to the agenda of the powerful, tells you all you need to know. This is about power and control. This is not about protection, safety, convenience, or security, except for their convenience and their security. And it's happening across the world. It's happening in the EU right now. The EU have passed the AI Act, a law accused of legalizing biometric mass surveillance in Europe. What's wonderful about this law is at the beginning, they're saying this is to protect to you from AI. You're concerned about AI, right? You're concerned about it, that it's going to be used to control you, that, I don't know, Skynet could happen one day. Or somehow they've been able to maneuver and mangle this piece of legislation into legitimizing yet more surveillance. And as the headline tells you, even biometric surveillance. The European Parliament has passed the AI Act. This is passed, a piece of legislation that started to be drafted back in 2021, wow, in the midst of the pandemic, as a way to prevent mass surveillance based on biometrics, but has now, in fact, promoted this practice into law. Isn't this another Orwellian oxymoron? A law that was designed to protect you and prevent biometric surveillance has literally legitimized biometric surveillance. And it's a law that will enter into force this May after receiving a blessing, that's an odd piece of religious language, from the Council of the EU. And it's perhaps deliberately religious because they have taken the place of God. These banal bureaucracies are taking the role of deities. That's why they want to wipe away your traditions and your connection to family and to God so that they can replace them with the capture of your biometric data in order to protect you on an arc of their own imagination, where two by two or en masse, it's all the same to them. We are corralled into floating prisons and penitentiaries. The EU, for its part, announced the adoption of the AI Act as a landmark event and touts it as providing safeguards regarding AI's general purpose, as well as limiting the use of identification systems by law enforcement. It aims to protect fundamental rights, democracy, the rule of law, and environmental sustainability from high-risk AI, while boosting innovation and establishing Europe as a leader in the field, a press release said. Well, there you have it. Let's have a look. I think we've got another still on that story. However, some members could not disagree more and have voted against it. They assert that the drafting of the AI Act was accompanied by trilogue negotiations between the EP, the European Commission and the Council of the EU that were not transparent enough and resulted in changes to the original idea that now effectively allows law enforcement the introduction of error-prone facial surveillance and facial recognition camera software in public spaces. As MEP Patrick Breyer stated on his blog, Breyer refers to these and other tools now at the EU government's disposal, such as real-time surveillance of public places, racial classifications and unscientific AI, as authoritarian instruments that threaten to turn democracies into high-tech surveillance states. Well, where have we heard that before? Isn't this precisely what we've been concerned about? We've got so much more for you coming up. That's why it is worth becoming a member of our Awakened Wonder community, because you can join me live for interviews with brilliant commentators and thinkers like Neil Oliver, who our Awakened Wonder community saw me with for an hour a little earlier today. We make additional exclusive videos that are only available to our locals community, like one on Kate Middleton and what it tells us about old power versus new power and their inability to navigate social media spaces. Coming up in a minute, we've got some astonishing content on what's going on in Ireland that you will love and how it's a sort of a war on our values. And of course, the story that you most wanted to see is the CDC's redaction of vital, important and information that frankly should have been public. We've got Roseanne Barr coming up on the show as well pretty soon. Is this a good time for me to do a little bit of promo before getting into things? Let's have a look at that then. Let's have a look at it. So this is about our partners today that are called Bioptimizers. Check this out. We're very grateful to our partners. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about them. Magnesium Breakthrough is an all-natural supplement that helps you reduce fatigue and sleep more peacefully. And I need it. We work all the live long day to work on this content. It even strengthens muscle and improves your heart and brain function. And who among us doesn't require that as we approach this revolutionary era? So if you want to feel more energized, I do, and get the best night's sleep you've ever had, oh, wouldn't that be beautiful? To fall into the world of slumber, to live there in a reality created entirely by your own consciousness that helps us to understand the nature of this reality and its significance and the archetypes that we encounter, and that there's a deep mythic reality accessible to us if we'll only do the work. Check out this site. There's the link in the description there, bioptimizers.com/brand. If you use that code brand, you'll unlock a bunch of special offers, plus they'll know that their adverts with us work, so you'll be helping us by doing that. So that's our partner today. The information, as you can see, is on the screen right now. So let's have a look at the story that we told you that we would cover in some detail. The CDC redacting information. Now, this is a southwestern intergovernmental committee, and it's amazing to see one of the participants brandishing a document of 140-odd pages, I think, each one of them redacted in order to what? To protect you, presumably. Let's have a look at it.
I find information like this, you know, inserts for the vaccine. Paper's there, and there's nothing printed on it. I find that very interesting, disheartening, disgusting, and lots of other words. But then it gets better. It just keeps, wait, there's more. It just keeps happening. The CDC redacts every single word of a 148-page study on a myocarditis after COVID vaccination. So I asked research to print the study for me.
Good. Finally, we'll get to the bottom of this. Let's have a look at the study.
148 pages. The entire thing is redacted. What good does a study do if there's nothing there? Then I want to know, wait, what might have been there that they needed to redact it?
Well, obviously, that information was so heartening and encouraging that we'd have all read it and just marched merrily into the streets and began dancing and skipping and celebrating so gleefully that we'd have been a risk to ourselves and one another. Why, we could have tumbled into a gutter. We could have walked in front of a moving vehicle. It's obvious.
And scarier.
We're witnessing an active cover-up of a colossal...
Here's our friend Peter McCulloch. I like him. The familiar tones of Peter McCulloch critiquing the bureaucratic managerial class and their censorial agenda.
Consumer product safety debacle that is basically affecting the entire world.
Killer Gorilla says in the Rumble chat they have to redact it to protect you. Thank you. Protect us more. Protect us more.
So in the United States, our CDC, National Institutes of Health, and the FDA are actively involved in a cover-up. And the same is occurring in the UK with the MHRA, Europe with European Medicine Agencies, and Australia with the Therapeutic Goods Administration. Something is going on that's...
Something is going on, and it's happening across the world.
Very big. Each one of these companies that puts out a product has an obligation to produce 90 days of safety monitoring.
Firewalk with me. Vaccines are now gluten-free. That's encouraging.
After their product comes out, it's a regulatory dossier. If somebody has a problem with the new product and they call the company like Pfizer, Pfizer has to report, write down what happened, and they have to collate that in a report and produce it and make it publicly available. When it came to 90 days with Pfizer, the first vaccine that came out, remember Pfizer was approved December 10th, 2020, Pfizer didn't produce the report. And then people started asking, well, what's happening with your vaccine? And Pfizer would not disclose what happened. And then it went to court. And the lawyer for the FDA stepped in and said they don't want to release Pfizer's dossier for 55 years. Mm-hmm. Oh. 55 years.
Doesn't look good, does it? I know a lot of you knew this already, and we all recall that as being one of the pivotal moments where our mistrust concretized when Pfizer wouldn't share clinical data with the public for a medication that was significantly publicly funded initially in Germany, you're well aware, but ultimately its purchase was undergirded by your tax dollars. And when it comes to, can you give us the information? Not only did Pfizer refuse to give it over, but the regulatory body that are supposed to be representing your interests, if necessary, against Big Pharma, sided as usual with Big Pharma. I wonder what's wrong with their funding model.
And the plaintiff pushed, and finally, slowly, the
critical thought in the Awakened Wonder chat: not vaccines, vax genes, not bad.
The Pfizer dossier came out. Pfizer recorded 1,223 deaths with their product within 90 days of release. People were product to the Pfizer dossier came out. Pfizer recorded 1,223 deaths with their product within 90 days of release.
That's not a story you hear very often, is it?
People were calling Pfizer in desperation, watching their family members die after taking the vaccine. Pfizer recorded over 1,200 new adverse events, new problems that Dr. Bowden has talked to you about that we are grappling with the entire time. But the point is, our FDA worked to cover this up. The FDA should be regulating this company. FDA should have been having at least monthly meetings and fully disclosing what was going on with these novel vaccines, which are...
Whoa, hard cut out there. Sorry, guys, but what an extraordinary story. And remember, the Supreme Court are now going to bat out the idea that the Biden administration were pressuring social media sites to censor when we know they were. We've just heard it again because people were saying, oh, are you sure this vaccine's safe? Because we're having some pretty serious problems in our family. Ivermectin couldn't be said out loud. Natural immunity couldn't be said out loud. Hydroxychloroquine, I still can't properly say out loud, but that's not entirely because of censorship. That's just because I keep forgetting how you're supposed to say it. I know there's a sort of technique, isn't it? It's like do it. Someone will post it in a minute and tell me that the way to break it up in your mind that makes it work. Or maybe Gareth, your great off-screen icon. Do you know how to say it? Hydroxychloroquine. Yeah, that's it. You've got to get that quin. Hydroxychloroquine. And throughout that period, we now know that the FBI were issuing edicts that were sort of self-deleting, which is against, once again, numerous federal laws, you know, that the CIA were embedded. And look at this from the New York Times. This is taken from within the pandemic era. It's interesting. The CDC isn't publishing large portions of the COVID data it collects. This was during the pandemic, this story. Okay, it's from 2022. For more than a year, The CDC has collected data on hospitalizations for COVID-19 in the US and broken it down by age, race, and vaccination status, but has not made most of the information public. That information was a surprise for your birthday. When the CDC published the first significant data on the effectiveness of boosters in adults younger than 65 2 weeks ago, it left out the numbers for a huge portion of that population, 18 to 49-year-olds. The group least likely to benefit from extra shots. Why would that be? Two full years into the pandemic, the agency leading the country's response to the public health emergency has published only a tiny fraction of the data it's collected. Several people familiar with the data said, well, let's start looking at all of the forces triangulating around this. The FBI, the Supreme Court, social media, companies, something pretty serious is going on, right? Something pretty serious is going on. The CDC has been routinely collecting information since the COVID vaccines were first rolled out last year, according to a federal official familiar with the matter. The agency has been reluctant to make those figures public. Why? The official said, because it might be misinterpreted as the vaccines being ineffective. They are censoring the things that we say to one another. They are censoring the information that they gather for themselves. Ultimately, really why this is, I've said it before, I'm sure I'll say it again. The truth is that they have to curate and manage reality to prevent us from becoming revolutionary. That's basically it, isn't it? That whether it's Google curating your newsfeed to direct you towards certain particular candidates, the various tools of censorship that are being implemented, en masse, you can't have people waking up to the reality that the institutions of government are totally corrupt and operate in the service of a globalist agenda, that there's potentially something even more nefarious at play. You know, the kind of, you know, you talk about you lunatics in the Rumble chat and you lot in the Awaken Wonder chat. You know, we're talking about, I don't know. The CDC is controlled by Fauci. Well, he's sort of retired, hasn't he? Now, okay. And this is another piece of information that suggests extraordinary activity. CDC covered up COVID vaccine myocarditis risks, show emails and reports. I mean, this is, I guess, about a year old, this, I think. A mounting body of evidence shows that the CDC and the White House chose to ignore and cover up evidence of a significant myocarditis safety signal in early 21, putting young people at risk of serious adverse events. On April 27, 2021, Len Director Rochelle Walensky stated, "We've not seen any reports of post-vaccination myocarditis because we're refusing to look at them." It was a false statement at the time. Journalist Zachary Stieber of the Epoch Times obtained internal CDC emails for a Freedom of Information Act request. Well done with the patients. When Walensky claimed to have not seen any reports, there were dozens of reports in the US Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS. Although we can't know for sure if Walensky had seen reports of post-vaccine myocarditis, a US government memorandum from March 2021 obtained by Stieber stated there were 27 cases of myocarditis, myopericarditis, and pericarditis on VARS or VAERS, however you say that. In June 2021, after most people who were planning to get vaccinated and received at least one jab, the CDC began publicly investigating myocarditis and speaking to the media about it. Oh, man. Stephen E., monkey emoji covering the eyes. I don't see any myocarditis. Mate, that ain't good. It's not a good look, is it? It's pretty extraordinary. Hey, listen, you guys. Oh, we didn't show you the clip of our... what number's that on? A clip from the exclusive video. Do you remember, Gal? 22. Have a look at this. Like, this is why it's worth becoming an Awakened Wonder. You get to join us. Does Russell just read the comments out from locals? No, your one's on Rumble. I read them out from everywhere. So have a look at this. This is one of the videos we make only for locals. I think you'll like it. Have a look.
I suppose we should remain open-minded to the possibility that she's had something that's sensitive, particularly female, embarrassing, because it's gastric or digestive, all sorts of things I suppose people wouldn't want to discuss. But wouldn't, if it were a hysterectomy, they'd just go, "It was a hysterectomy, give her a break." So that's, I suppose, why we're curious. And what you wouldn't do is put out a photograph that's manipulated. What seems likely, possible, feasible, is the compliance of Kate can no longer be relied upon. Is that what you guys think? That she's just gone, "I'm not doing this stuff no more"?
I want to welcome our new members that can get access to that content. They'll see our chemtrails video. Who's the guy I've got to talk to about chemtrails again? You guys are always telling me someone that's the expert so we can make sure our research is bang on point. I want to welcome all of you. I want to welcome Holly Herring, Chris Blazer, Max Power, Lisa Morgs, Lee Legend. I want to welcome all of you. Have you seen our book club yet? I don't know where C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity is. But we're looking at that, in particular, Mere Christianity, and we look at other great books as well. I think that, like, you know, here's a photo of Kate Middleton. She's alive and well. She's doing fantastic. Now, listen, the globalist project is collapsing. The Irish people have rejected an important referendum, and I think you guys are going to see a lot of cause for optimism here, because it's happening around the world. What they wanted to do is change the definition of family in Ireland, which is, in a sense, something that's against their traditions, their connection to community and their values. Does this indicate, then, that we might see a return to faith, a return to tradition, a growing lack of trust in government? And does this actually expose just how reckless the elite's culture war on the people they are callously governing has become? Here's the news. No. Here's the effing news.
Thank you for choosing Fox.
Here's the news. No, here's the fucking news.
Ireland's leaders are completely out of touch with the people that they govern, and now there's been a referendum that proves it. They've rejected the culture war. They are embracing tradition. So does that mean that the people of Ireland need to be persecuted with new hate laws and censorship laws? Or does it just mean that the Irish people and their leaders need to separate? Ironically, get a divorce. One thing's for sure, the offering of the Irish elite to the Irish people has been resoundingly rejected. They wanted to change the wording around family and the roles of women within the family, and they asked the Irish people, do you want to make these changes? And the Irish people said no. So we're going to have a look at that referendum, or that pair of referenda, and what it means and how it can be used to demonstrate that increasingly what we have is an elite class that use progressivism to condemn entire populations as some out of touch and lost in the mists of time. And I think that what's happening in Ireland exemplifies a global phenomena that's, of course, happening everywhere. The ruling elites of America don't like ordinary American people and want to condemn them. The ruling elites in the UK don't like the British and want to condemn them. And I feel that what will emerge from this is a new type of politics, and it's fascinating to see it evolve. Just because it's coming from the past, it doesn't mean that it's entirely nostalgic. What it means is people are rejecting this new agenda that seeks to wipe away everything of value that includes family and tradition, but also quite deep-seated ideas like our connection to the divine nature and God. Let's get into this news story and work out what it means for us as an awakening planet.
We start with breaking news. The Irish Prime Minister has conceded defeat in the nation's referendum on modernising its constitution.
Modernising its constitution. It's one of those referendums where all of the major parties backed a particular answer. A lot like Brexit, really, or a lot like how all of the media don't want Americans to vote for Trump. The whole establishment class is telling you, do this, do this. And the whole population is curiously saying, we're not doing that, or at least a significant portion of the population. In many cases, enough to win elections. This is a real problem for the ruling elite.
Leo Varadkar says it was already clear the amendments over the definition of family and the woman's role at home had been defeated. Well, that's despite the counting of votes still taking place. Speaking in the last hour, Mr. Varadkar said his government accepted full responsibility. This is the quote. It says, it was our responsibility to convince the majority of people to vote yes, and we clearly failed to do so.
It's fascinating because Ireland's got a very particular history that's built in adversity to the UK and therefore facilitates a relationship with the EU that's perhaps a little more favourable. But now, these kind of bureaucratic and centralised authoritarian forces have become completely deracinated from the people in various territories that they purport to govern, believing in ideas of cultural progressivism, which undoubtedly have their place and are, in my view, matters of personal freedom. But Ireland, with its long strong affiliation with Catholicism. It's going to have a very particular social perspective. Ireland, with its long military opposition to the UK and the oppressive forces and religious oppression that came out of the UK, are going to have a very particular perspective. And something that goes even beyond that is populations have the right to determine for themselves whether or not they want to be pro or anti-immigration, whether or not they want to be pro or anti-marriage. That's something that in a democracy you can decide for yourselves. My personal view is that people have the right to consensually express their sexuality with loving partners or perfect strangers in the context of consent. But if a country votes that what they want to revere, honour and enshrine is the traditional family, then I suppose they have the right to do that, don't they?
Hugely embarrassing for the Irish government, this. This was a referendum, or two referendums, as you mentioned there, that no government in this country ever expected to lose. For many years here, commentators and the governments thought that when we eventually got around to having a referendum addressing this outdated language, that it would pass with ease. But this has been a lesson in how not to run a referendum campaign by Leo Varadkar and his government.
It also might be a bigger lesson in the way that the world has changed. The world is changing, and how many of the cultural, social, and economic experiments that define our planet at this time are failing. They're not working for a good many people. Whether you're voting for Trump or Brexit, one interpretation of that electoral process and preference could be a rejection of the neoliberal establishment and their ideas. And that's a kind of understandable position when we seem to be experiencing decline, dishonesty, deception, and even, at worst, a type of nihilism and a deliberate attempt to make us all feel sort of bewildered, like nothing is certain and none of our traditions have any meaning.
But I can tell you in the count centres, it was obvious from very early on this morning when we watched the first boxes being opened and the tallies conducted of the ballot papers within. It was very obvious right across the Dublin constituencies and right across the rural constituencies, a consistent trend. People were giving this government a bloody nose today.
Yeah, brilliant article from Spiked that analyses this result. The referendums proposing changes to the constitutional definition of family and on the issue of care were comprehensively defeated in Ireland last week, with the latter rejected by a record margin. Voters were asked to say yes or no to two amendments to the Constitution of 1937. First, they were asked if they wanted to change the meaning of the word family so that it would extend beyond marriage to include other durable relationships. Then they were asked if they'd like to change the Constitution's focus on a woman's duties in the home by adding a new clause acknowledging that all sorts of family members provide care in the domestic setting. The political class invested huge amounts of money and energy into encouraging voters to say yes to these sweeping tweaks, but voters refused to play ball. 68% said no to altering the definition of family, and 74% said no to updating the section on a woman's duties. It was a crushing defeat for the establishment. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin all lined up behind yes. Dublin's chattering class is fuming with the voters. They've rejected an opportunity to extract Ireland from the constitutional straitjacket of Catholic social teaching and anachronistic views about women and girls, says one columnist. This vision of certain Irish people as anachronistic and the constitution itself as hopelessly outdated is widespread among the educated classes. Indeed, Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said it was time to change the very old-fashioned, very sexist language about women in the constitution. In the elite's eyes, presumably, the folk who said no to this project of modernisation are both very old-fashioned and very sexist. It's possible, of course, that people have a different view on what those roles constitute. I participate a good deal in the care of my own children, and the fact that in our household that duty is primarily undertaken by the mother is not seen as a denigrated role, but an elevated one. In truth, voters were defending their way of life. They were standing up for institutions and ideas that matter hugely to them, marriage, motherhood, against the unilateral meddling of a distant establishment. That's important as well, isn't it? That people feel more connected to their family and their community and their church and their values, to this class of institutions that appear to have some other aim in mind. And those aims don't appear to be taking us anywhere very pleasant, very fast. They understand that adding other forms of durable relationships alongside marriage in the constitution will represent an implicit demotion of the importance of marriage. The specialness of marriage is diluted when it's treated as just another relationship. It clearly feels alien to elites of a globalist bent that ordinary people still put so much store by marriage, but they do. Dublin's elite might derive their sense of meaning and clout from modern forms of networking and ideological camaraderie, but others prefer the rooted experience of lifelong commitment. For many, marriage is their most important source of solidarity. minority. I would say that in a voting to honour a traditional perspective, that needn't be prejudicial to people that are in same-sex relationships or even are not married. Love is love, partnership is partnership. But I suppose what they're saying is marriage is a very particular ceremony that is about religious faith and is in particular about a declaration before God. And also, by the way, there was a vote on it and the people voted this way. The elites are rolling out their excuses for why they failed to get their way. The referendum questions were worded badly, voters were hoodwinked by the far right, etc., etc. In truth, the dual referendum represented an existential clash of values, and the values the elites don't like won the day. To many of us, it makes perfect sense that ordinary people would go out to defend the institution of marriage and the traditional family. After all, these are institutions in which people take refuge from the vagaries of market society and cultivate their own spaces of love, independence and solidarity. That strikes me as a very important line. At the moment, the world feels sort of bewildering, nihilistic, cold and harsh, corrupted, owned by very particular sets of power, and your own family and your own values and your own relationship with the sacred and divine, your own personal sovereignty are very important ideas. It's odd to imagine that the state would be interested in anything other than facilitating the further advances of elite institutions, both economic and state, and the declaration that they're interested in equality of types of relationship and types of marriages, I think the people have smelt as bogus and untrue, based on the actions of these institutions. The instinct of the post-national elites might be to throw open everything, the state, society, community, to the requirements of global capital, but the instinct of others is to do the opposite, to batten down the hatches of home life against what they rightly perceive to be the economic and ideological menaces of neoliberalism. Even more important, the resounding no vote was a defence of the past from an elite that prefers the constant churn of modernisation to any appeals to tradition. Varadkar's invitation to the Irish people to overhaul the very old-fashioned language of the constitution was telling. It spoke to the elite's agitation with all things old, their discomfort with history itself. You get the impression these days that the Dublin establishment is mortified that it runs a country that was once so religious and so rural. Waging ceaseless war on Ireland's own past is increasingly the means through which Ireland's new rulers seek to demonstrate their moral fitness for membership of the globalist superclass. National self-loathing is a veritable industry in modern Ireland. Cultural influences have reimagined the past as a constant hell of Magdalene laundries, spiteful priests, alcoholism, stupidity, and petty nationalism. Virtually every Irish film and novel is a depressing tale of how ignorance once reigned supreme on this benighted isle. The old English caricatures of the Irish as a feckless race have nothing on the new Dublin elite's caricature of the Irish as the damaged victims of a demagogic church and nationalist strongmen. You don't have to think old Ireland was perfect to recognise that these grotesque renderings of Irish history are less about historical truth than about proving the virtue of the new elite by constantly contrasting it with the vices of the old. So history is being desecrated and cast aside. We're all aware that there were certain and obvious problems with the Catholic Church and that there is certainly room for progress, tolerance, inclusion when it comes to different ways of identifying through your sexuality and identity. But the right of people to revere, to love their tradition and ancestors is not only, one might argue, a necessity, but something that is inherently human. And increasingly, as we see progress fumble and fail, technology further facilitates tyranny rather than the ease and comfort it promises. It's pretty obvious that one of the things that people are reaching towards is the sense of comfort that comes from loving, for example, your own grandparents and not regarding them as bigoted old fools. Last week's dual referendums must be seen in this cultural context as the latest elite effort to unanchor Ireland from its past, to liberate the nation from its historical shame. In spurning this invitation, in refusing to disavow the very old-fashioned and very sexist founding document of their nation, voters were not only saying screw you to the current establishment, they were also revolting against the cult of year zero, against the frenzied disembedding of nations from their pasts. This is a core part of the woke project, the inculcation of historical shame in the public in order that they might agree to be delivered into a newer, better, woker future by a self-styled enlightened ruling class. This is perhaps the most I've ever understood the cultural damage that apparent progressivism can do. In the same way that I can easily identify that technology promises to facilitate ease for all of us, but ultimately ends up being used to facilitate the control of the establishment and the profits of already wealthy institutions and corporations. Wokeism pretends that it's about equality and caring for the values of people that might be oppressed. And these are important arguments that need to be honoured in some way. But it seems that these cultural arguments, as the author of this piece suggests, are used to disable and destabilise communities and individuals' relationships with their own past and their own values. Suddenly something important makes sense. And it's a project the Irish people have just said no to. Across the West, performative hostility to one's history is all the rage in establishment circles. You see it in the US, in the efforts of media elites to alter the very founding date of America from 1776, the year of the American Revolution, to 1619, the year slaves first arrived. You see it in the UK, where the National Trust lectures us about our history of slavery. The Church of England issues solemn apologies for its links with colonialism, and bourgeois youths tear down statues of problematic people and demand the renaming of buildings and streets. You see it in the European Union, which depicts everything that happened prior to 1945 as iffy and archaic, and everything since then as a gallant effort to socially re-engineer the continent as a woke, peaceful entity. I feel when I read that, that you can't have your cake and eat it. You can't keep the nation and then strip out everything that keeps its structures in place. If you feel there is something inherently patriarchal and therefore wrong about a structure, then you have to review it in its entirety. You can't keep its financial structures, its institutions of government, and just change some of the edifices and statues while maintaining the true power in its place, globalist elite, unassailable and unattainable for most. It seems that people are content to alter words here and there to change the superficial arraignments, but never address the true nature of power. In short, if you want to radically re-alter the way that power operates, then you're going to have to do away with the concept of the nation itself, rather than say we have a nation, but now this nation doesn't mean the historic struggle against British oppression and Michael Collins and 1916 and all of the historic fights of the Irish people and the famine. Now it means all this new stuff. Can't say that because those people don't have those memories. They don't have that tradition. They don't have that past. And you can't, because of that, just tell them that they're stupid. And in Ireland, you see it everywhere in culture, entertainment, politics. Witness not only the fashionable shame the smart set feels towards the Catholic era, but also their bristling disdain for the very founding of the nation. Even Easter 1916 is an embarrassment to the new elite that prefers to pool its sovereignty in the EU rather than stand up for the territorial sanctity of the Republic. That young men and women died in order that Ireland might govern itself is mortifying to these knowledge industry elites who prefer to be governed from Brussels, and so they distance themselves even from the ideals of Irish independence. We want nothing to do with a backward-looking idea of sovereignty, said then-leader of the opposition and now Taoiseach Michael Martin in 2017. Instead, Ireland is absolutely committed to the EU, he decreed. Nationhood is out. Subservience to globalist institutions is in. Thank the Lord we can bring you this content because of the support of our sponsors. Support them if you can. Today, I want to talk to you about Field of Greens. It's the healthiest thing I do every day. And I want you on this journey with me, side by side. It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. My favourite is the original flavour. And it's completely improved my life. This is nutrition, the way that nature intended, in a scoop. Here's what I noticed since I started taking Field of Greens. Way more energy over the course of the day. Sleeping better at night, like a baby. As you know, they're truculent and difficult at nighttime, so I sleep better than one. Healthier hair and skin. It helps with my digestion. My stomach feels better. I feel better overall, and I think healthier and stronger. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support the heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you're going to love this product, but if any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guarantee. Now listen, I've got you 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping. Visit brickhouserussell.com and use promo code BRAND. That's promo code BRAND at brickhouserussell.com. They'll know I sent you. Okay, let's get back to the story. The educated position today is to rise above the past, to look down on it, to distance oneself from yesteryear's very old-fashioned ideals. Ordinary people's refusal to do this, their stubborn insistence on valuing history and its achievements, bemuses the elites as much as it horrifies them. To the rest of us, though, again, it makes sense. People want to feel connected to history, to place, to their own part in the story of their community. The elite suggestion that we disavow all of this is ultimately a demand that we disavow ourselves. Modern Ireland, more than any other European nation, reveals the destructive truth about woke. There is a tendency to see woke as a joke, as the daft pastime of bourgeois blue hairs, as the ideological exuberance of posh kids led astray on campus. In truth, woke is a mammoth elite project whose fundamental aim is to remake and improve the masses. It is a process of dehistoricization, deterritorialization, and demoralization. That is, it seeks to rent us from our own history by inducing shame towards the past. It aims to deprive us of a meaningful connection to territory by diluting national sovereignty and moving us ever closer to a globalist system of governance. And it longs to re-educate us out of our problematic morals, our very old-fashioned beliefs in things like family, marriage, motherhood, even biological sex, through the relentless promotion of supposedly better, more enlightened ways of thinking. Thinking about social relations. Ireland is further advanced than most in this authoritarian project. Shame about 1916, open disdain for sovereignty, never-ending alarm over the religious excesses of the 20th century. This is the stuff of intellectual discourse among Dublin's movers and shakers. There are few cultural elites as boastfully alienated from their history and their people as Ireland's. That's what the dual referendum really represented, a further attempt to entrench the cultural power of this new establishment and to diminish the very old-fashioned morality of the masses. The elite's stunning defeat in this staged clash over history and over meaning itself is an important moment. What many people instinctively recognise is that the enforced alienation of them from their own history, territory and morality would render them more malleable to the new ruling class. It would make them blank slates onto which the year zero elites could write whatever story and ideology they wanted. In such circumstances, people's clinging to tradition, their pulling up of the blanket of the past, is not anachronistic, it's survival. It's an act of self-protection against an establishment that prefers us suggestible rather than rooted and confident. Family, community, tradition, these are people's last remaining shields against the true ignoble fanatics, our year zero rulers. Often when you hear about a globalist project, a great reset, the idea that we will be uprooted and lost, that a new set of rules, a new agenda will be imposed, it's difficult to see how such a vast and expansive project could ever be understood. But through the unique lens of Ireland's politics and the deep sympathy that that nation engenders through their own historic struggles, you can see, as you could with the immigration struggles of a few months ago, that what's happening is a transplanted ideology is being dropped on it from above. And when you can understand it about Ireland, you can see how it's happening in the UK, how it's happening in the United States. And the fact that the history of your country, America, and our country is beset with problems of imperialism and colonialism doesn't mean that ordinary working people that live in our nations now should have their rights similarly dispatched. The dismissal of Catholic values, for example, is very similar to what British imperialists would have said about the Hindu folk and Muslim folk in India and what is now Pakistan. Although, Jesus, what an extraordinary concoction those national projects are when you think about it. They would have laughed about the gods and the elephant gods and the monkey gods, thinking that it is their duty to impose Christ upon those nations. And now you see that the very same game is being played out through bureaucracy, with the woke ideology forging a new pantheon of gods and ideals with which to supplant the previous traditions and communities and values that the people in these referenda have said, no, 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 we're keeping that. That's our grandparents. That's our streets. That's our lives. That's our memories, our Christmases and our Easters and our pain and funerals that we've been to. Funerals sometimes that were a result of the kind of establishmentism that you're now trying to re-render in a banal and rational way. But every bit as insidious as the funerals that were held across the country of Ireland because of previous, more militaristic forms of colonialism. Ireland has become hyperwoke. Its elites are fully converted to the gender cult. They promote the ruthless policing of hate speech, which really means dissent. They damn as far right anyone who raises a peep of criticism about immigration. Their culture war on the past is relentless. Woke is the state religion of Ireland now. And if you thought Catholic Ireland was sexist, irrational, and illiberal, just wait until you see what wokeness unleashes. Science made subservient to ideology. Dissenters rebranded as haters and threatened with censorship and possibly even jail. Ireland's godless new ruling class is easily as backward and tyrannical as any of the priests of old. The irony is too much. In ostentatiously distancing themselves from bad old religious Ireland, the elites have created a system of neo-religious dogmas that makes the Catholic era seem positively progressive in comparison. This new clerisy is far more reactionary, far more menacing to liberty and reason than the little old lady who pops a miraculous medal in with her ballot paper. Long may the blasphemy army against its ideology continue. Well, there you are. It seems that across the world, globalism and this new imperialism is being rejected, and continually it is necessary for it to be reframed as a kind of terrorism or a kind of hatred, a kind of domestic war against important and somehow holy new values, when quite the reverse might be true. That people are sensing that what's being imposed is something terrible, tyrannical, authoritarian, nihilistic all at once. And whenever there's an opportunity for anything remotely resembling an election, the people speak pretty clearly, as they have done in Ireland. No wonder elections these days are subject of so much controversy and control, whether it's the media controlling the elections, social media censoring true debate, and potentially even more nefarious activity than that. And in a year of elections, which is what 2024 is, we're going to see a lot more stories like this one. So stay tuned and stay free. But that's just what I think. Why don't you let me know what you think in the comments in the chat? Remember, click the link in the description, become a member of our movement. We make content like this all the time. We have additional videos and additional meetings. We're planning all sorts of crazy stuff. There are videos on chemtrails. There's videos on Kate Middleton. There are videos on subjects that are difficult to discuss in mainstream spaces. But most of all, we're interested in how power operates and how power asserts its influence through conventional media channels. More important than any of that, if you can, please stay free. Many switch in, switch off. Many switch in, switch on, switch off.